It is 8:30, and we have with us, live in the studios, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Give them a morning.
It's a little
kind
chilly
of,
in
kind
here.
Kind of chilly here in the studio. But it'll, I mean, you know, probably about 3 o'clock this afternoon, we'll wish we were back here.
Yeah. You will. You will. You look back fondly on this
yeah, really.
30 minutes. So, all right. Well, let's start things out today a little differently. You guys are in the middle of a massive fund drive.
Massive, huge.
Yeah, you know, hundreds of volunteers in the ETS office.
Yeah, exactly. The phones are ringing off the hook. Eat the State. Just pretend this is your average non-commercial radio pledge drive for a minute, because that really is basically what Eat the State is. Also, it's a volunteer community oriented. Media outlet, and unfortunately without nearly the resources that most other media outlets you're familiar with do have, and we've got a printer debt and so forth, so we are trying to raise money. And one of the biggest ways that we have been able to raise money in the past has been through the generosity of people who listen to this program, because they really folks out there seem to appreciate what we do on weekend mornings rather. And you know, we can't keep doing it, either in print or on the radio, really. If we don't have any way to pay the printer bill and to, you know, to meet the obligations that help us put the information out, so we are trying different ways to make it easy. We have a PayPal account set up on the Eat the State website, www.eatthestate.org. The phone number is 206.
903-9461.
That's right. We got to do it in unison.
Operators are standing by.
Yes. Automated voicemail is standing by, or you can send donations directly to the Eat the State PO Box, which is eagerly awaiting your donations. That's PO Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And if you didn't have a pencil and paper ready for all of that, we'll repeat it later on in the show toward the end. But just to say that we really appreciate the help that people have given in the past, and you know, it takes money to keep the news rolling, and that's what we're trying to accomplish. And we've been very generous so far, but we have a goal of $6,000, and we're only about halfway there, and we got about 2 weeks left.
Yeah.
To get to that goal. So this won't go on forever.
No. $6,000 should get you through about half the year?
Yeah, that's
quarter?
About right.
Okay.
It's about $800 an issue.
If everybody
two issues a month.
Cough something up now, then we won't be bothering you for another 6 months till Christmas time.
We promise, yes. At which point, just like every other nonprofit in the universe, we try and hook people up, because people are strangely generous that time of year. So
yeah. I think it has something to do with tax codes, which we'll be getting to later.
Yes.
Yes, we'll be talking about that later.
Of course, the tax codes we'll be talking about later aren't the same tax codes that most of our listeners have to respond to.
But, right.
Because that's what people in Congress design. But anyway, we do appreciate the support, and please give.
Very good. All right. Well, moving on to this week's events, the monorail. Monorail had a big vote at City Council this week, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Folks might remember the contentious vote over whether or not the monorail should run through the Seattle Center, that passed by a 5-4 vote. It was interesting because this week the council voted on the final alignment of the monorail for its whole length. And instead of being a narrow 5-4 vote, after a number of city council members went down and checked out the Las Vegas monorail route that was built by Bombardier, one of the companies that'll be bidding on the monorail project here, they came back, and instead of it being a 5-4 vote, it was an 8-1 vote for the new monorail alignment. The holdout was Richard Conlon, and he cited the concerns of neighborhood groups without being specific. And he also talked about the alignment through the Seattle Center.
Yeah, and it's ironic that people seem to have had a change of heart after going down to Las Vegas, because if anything, Las Vegas is a tremendous cautionary tale for the route in Seattle. The Las Vegas route is basically a 4-mile route along the strip in Las Vegas. It's a straight shot. It's a straight route. It's a double track, and it was originally supposed to be open in March, and then they delayed it until June, and now they've delayed the opening another 3 months. And the reason they've delayed it has had to do with the software. They've managed to resolve the other problems, but they cannot get the software to work for the switching on the trains. Now, if the software can't work on a straight 4 mile route with a double track in Las Vegas, imagine how complicated it's going to be with a much longer, when what is now proposed to be a single track route in Seattle, where the switching is going to be much, much, much more complicated. The Las Vegas route, as it is unfolded so far, really raises serious questions about whether what's now being proposed in Seattle can even work, whether it's even a viable proposal or not.
Yeah, I do think this is a cautionary tale. Now, I'm for the monorail, and I don't make any secret about that, but I think that when they started talking about going from a double rail to a single rail route on the monorail, that really, I don't think folks knew up front what they were talking about, because if we go for a single rail route, there will be these issues of the complexity of operating it and maintaining it. In addition, there will be safety concerns.
Yeah, we saw that with the fire a couple weeks ago.
Right. One of the things that made the fire on the old monorail route not a big deal was that they could pull a second train up to the first one and evacuate people onto the second train.
Well, and also that they had a catwalk there, and what they're talking mm-hmm. about with the new proposal is that there would not be a catwalk for the length of it, and the fire department has come out after this fire and said there will have to be a catwalk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that makes complete and total sense, but I think on a double rail line that it would just add to the safety considerations on the whole route. Now, this is a much longer route than the one in Las Vegas, and it's going to be taking a lot of turns. It's going to be going up and down hills, et cetera. It's something that they really have to look at. They'll also have to look at the two companies that are bidding. Bombardier, one of the companies that's bidding on the Seattle route, is the company that built the Las Vegas route, and the other company that's bidding is Hitachi of Japan. The city council might have to look at that and say, well, do we want the Bombardier crew because of the problems with Las Vegas, or do we want the Hitachi crew?
I see a number of council members going to Kobe, Japan on taxpayer money in order to check
to
out,
check it out.
What Hitachi has built.
Yeah, that's going to be unavoidable, I'm afraid.
We'll have to check those receipts closely when they get back.
Mm-hmm.
All right, anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Well, let's. We talked about new tax laws, and there's some on the table now.
Yes. The WTO made a ruling a couple years back that the current U.S. tax code and the way it favors American corporations who operate abroad is an unfair trade practice. That it gives tax breaks to U.S. companies that aren't available to foreign companies. And the WTO has allowed the European Union to slap trade sanctions on the U.S. for this rule. And so what's happened is the Congress has had to address the tax code and try to make changes in order to get those sanctions lifted. Now,
and this was something that they had a deadline to meet last year and that they put off again and again.
Right. And I think they put off largely because of the war. Now, the reason we're talking about this now is because the Senate had passed a version of a bill that would amend the tax code. And then this week, the House passed their version. Inside this bill, one of the things that it does is it decreases the top corporate tax rate from 35% down to about 32%. So it gives a big tax break to all corporations, foreign and domestic. But it does something else. It allows companies who operate abroad, who have stashed their profits in tax havens in order to avoid paying U.S. taxes instead of bringing the profits home or repatriating them, as it's called. It allows them to repatriate those profits stashed in the foreign tax havens. And when they bring that money home, instead of paying the top corporate tax rate of 35%, which will now be 32%, they're allowed to pay a nominal tax of 5.25% on that money that they've stashed in their, foreign tax havens. Now, this provision in in addition to being an enormous giveaway to companies like GE, Intel, Halliburton, etc., in addition to being an enormous giveaway for those companies, it also is being billed as a job creation act. Now, the problem is that in at least one survey that has asked companies who have profits stashed in tax havens abroad, that has asked those companies what they would do with the money that they repatriated or that they brought back home after they paid the tiny little tax on it, those companies have said that they will use that money, that they will use the bulk of that or nearly all of that money to buy equipment, to pay off debt, and to buy back stock. None of those companies said that they would use it to hire more workers or retrain or provide benefits for their current workforce. None of those companies said that they would do that. So while it's being billed as a job creation provision, it is nothing at all like that. It is simply a giveaway to major corporations.
Yeah, and you're also going to see a loss of tax revenue in that this is a tremendous incentive for companies that are not now stashing profits overseas to start doing so. Because let's face it,
the ones that haven't been doing that, it punishes the companies that have been playing by the rules.
Yeah, because let's face it, most of these are simply electronic transfers where the money is moving around in name only. What you're basically doing is having companies send the money overseas. When the tax come due, they don't have to pay the taxes because the money's not in the U.S., and they move the money back in the U.S. So basically what it means is that companies are paying 5% on their profits.
Right. And they looked at the total numbers that would be involved here. There's an estimated $650 billion stashed in tax havens. That's just an estimate, and it's probably a low estimate. Of that $650 billion, they expect about $400 billion to be repatriated back to the U.S. because of this provision, and that on that $400 billion, corporations would pay about $2.8 billion in actual taxes after that 5.25% tax rate plus all the other tax breaks that corporations are allowed in this new bill.
Yeah.
Now, if corporations had been forced all along to repatriate that $650 billion by the tax code, if they'd been forced to repatriate it all along and they had to pay the top corporate tax rate on it, that would amount to $227.5 billion on $650 billion. So that gives you some idea of what the U.S. Treasury, what we, the people, are losing by giving this enormous tax break to corporations.
Yeah, and to put it another way, this is a tax rate that is far, far below what ordinary working and middle class people pay on their personal income taxes.
Once you take into account what we pay on our income taxes, plus what we pay for Social Security and Medicare and local sales taxes, et cetera, and state, if you live in a state where they where you have to pay income tax, ordinary Americans pay far more in taxes than corporations do.
Well, I think the job creation would be coming from those extra people that hire at the banks for the rake in the money.
Well, and CEOs, you can never have too many CEOs.
Yeah,
that's
so,
right.
Or vice presidents.
Hire an extra one or two.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, moving along. This week, I think was
too many chiefs, not enough. Never mind.
I think it was the final meetings of the 9/11 commission.
Well, the final public hearings.
Public
of the 9/11.
Hearings. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're
going to be issuing their final report next month, and we're starting to get these interim reports on different pieces of the 9/11 commission. And the one that was released this week had to do with examining the claims of links between Al Qaeda and the most notable provision had to do with examining the administration claims of links between Al Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's government in Iraq, and found lo and behold what many of us have been saying all along, that while there were contacts between the Iraqi government and al-Qaeda. Notably, in 1995, al-Qaeda approached the Iraqi government about possible corroboration. According to the commission report, there was no response from the Iraqi government to that approach. There is no evidence, according to the 9/11 Commission, that there was ever any active collaboration between the al-Qaeda terrorists and the Saddam Hussein's government in Iraq. Now, this is very, very different, even though you have, in sort of the damage control phase of this that's been unfolding in the last couple of days, you have both Thomas Kean, who's one of the co-chairs of the 9/11 Commission, the former Republican governor of New Jersey, and Richard Hamilton, the former Democratic congressman from Illinois. Both of them are saying, well, what the administration is saying isn't too different from what we're saying, but it is, because you have had Dick Cheney and George Bush coming out in the last couple of days and hammering once again on the point that not only was there contact between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, but they were actively working together, that you know, the Saddam Hussein's government, and I mean, usually they just personalize it as Saddam Hussein was part of the terror network, that this is part of the war on terror. And as you had I believe it was in the New York Times, what they call senior White House advisor, being quoted as saying, the reason that they're hammering away on this is that if you take away the underpinning for the rationale on the war, that there was this link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, that what you're left with is George W. Bush's cockeyed adventure in invading Iraq. And he's exactly right. That is exactly what you're left with, because there was no link. There was no reason to believe there would be a link. The supposed meetings that you had between Mohammed Atta and representatives of Saddam Hussein's intelligence services, there's no evidence that that meeting ever took place. And this is a key meeting that Dick Cheney and others have cited in the past. But still, you have the former CEO of Halliburton, who now happens to be a vice president, continuing to say and saying also that he has probably information that the 9/11 Commission does not have, raising a separate issue of why this information wasn't shared with the 9/11 Commission in the first place. So it's it really is two very different stories about what has happened here, and it's pretty obvious which story is credible and which story is not credible.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Oh, well, that takes us then to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
There was a lot of stuff that happened this week in Iraq, but I'm going to try to focus narrowly on a few things. The Open Society Institute, which is a nonprofit group that maintains a task force to monitor how the Coalition Provisional Authority is managing Iraq's oil industry, issued a report this week, and the report was entitled, quote, "Iraqi Fire Sale, CPA Giving Away Oil Revenue Billions Before the Transition." Now, I just want to read a couple of quotes from the report. The opening paragraph reads as follows. "The Coalition Provisional Authority has launched a last-minute spending spree using Iraq's oil money shortly before it is due to be dissolved. In a little-noticed move, the CPA is committing billions of dollars to hastily conceived projects on the eve of its completion deadline. The Program Review Board, which is the CPA's spending arm, will terminate operations on June 30th when political and financial autonomy is handed over to the recently appointed interim government."
Interim
government. Yeah, now the next paragraph reads, and this is kind of interesting, "In its latest available minutes, the Program Review Board on May 15th approved nearly $2 billion in expenditures for a host of poorly planned projects. It does not appear that all relevant ministries were consulted in the development of these funding requests. However, the new Iraqi government will have little choice but to honor the commitments. The resolution on Iraq passed by the UN Security Council on June 8th requires the new government to satisfy outstanding obligations against the Development Fund for Iraq, the main repository for Iraqi revenues." In other words, the Coalition Provisional Authority is looting the new treasury for the new interim government, and they're turning that money around and giving it to companies like Halliburton, etc., in order to fund projects that are going nowhere. A report this week on the Iraqi oil industry showed that of the 226 projects that were supposed to be funded and completed by April of this year, most of which were given to the Halliburton company, only about half of those projects were even underway. 94 of them were halfway completed, and none of them had been finished yet. Not a single one
That's
had
remarkable.
Been finished yet. That's right. Now, there were also some further revelations in the Halliburton scandal this week. Excuse me. Six contract workers told members of the House Committee of Government Reform, these are contract workers that worked for Halliburton, that they witnessed gross mismanagement by Halliburton in Iraq that included the company urging them to fill out time cards for hours that they did not work so that the company could collect money from the U.S. government on their behalf. Excuse me. $85,000 trucks were abandoned along the roadsides after minor breakdowns, like a flat tire, or they were simply driven into the ground for lack of basic maintenance. It includes paying $1 million to house 100 employees in a Kuwaiti hotel for 3 months against the Army's specific instructions, and then turning around and billing the Army for that. And, of course, there is the notorious scandal of Halliburton serving meals to U.S. troops and then billing for meals that were never served. Some 36% of the meals that they billed for, the Pentagon auditor estimates, were never served. Now, all these costs were reimbursed by the U.S. with U.S. taxpayer funds in a cost-plus contract. That those cost-plus contracts say that all the costs of the company will be paid by U.S. taxpayers, plus a little percentage in profit for the company. Halliburton has received about $4.5 billion to supply U.S. troops under the supply contract and about $8.2 billion to restore Iraq's oil fields. And as we're learning, they're receiving more money in Iraqi oil revenue that's supposed to go to the new government in order to fund its operations. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has withheld a measly $186 million, just a tiny little portion, for the meals that were billed that were never served. Now, the General Accounting Office of Congress told the House Government Reform Committee that the Pentagon may have wasted billions of U.S. taxpayer funds in Iraq because of poor planning and lack of oversight of these kinds of contracts, and that includes other contractors in addition to Halliburton. So Halliburton is just one example of the gross looting of U.S.
Yeah.
taxpayer funds.
And I have to say that if you or I did any kind of practices like this in our small business, we'd be in jail.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, really. I mean,
not
this is what this boils
business,
down
we'd
to.
Be in jail.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. Now, in addition, workers' compensation claims for private contractors killed in Iraq could cost the U.S. government additional millions because the 1941 Defense Base Act requires the U.S. government to reimburse insurance companies for claims made by the families of U.S. government contractors killed in the Iraqi war. So private contractors like the employees of Halliburton who have been killed, Halliburton and other companies like the Vinyl Corp, et cetera, who have been killed in Iraq during these hostilities. So that's a major drawback of using private contractors in order to do things like, guard convoys of supplies supplying U.S. troops because we don't
interrogate prisoners.
Right, because we don't have enough U.S. troops in Iraq because Donald Rumsfeld, well, he wanted to do this on the cheap. So, additionally, this week, 26 former diplomats and high-ranking military officers urged that Bush be voted out of office because of his incompetency. Now, I just want to read a couple quotes from their
And this is bipartisan. This is people who served under Reagan and Bush Sr.
Yes,
also.
Yes, from their statement, and I'll name some of the signers here, too. I just want to read a couple of quotes here. Never in the 2 1/4 centuries of our history has the United States been so isolated among the nations, so broadly feared and distrusted. No loyal American would question our ultimate right to act alone in our national interest, but responsible leadership would not turn to unilateral military action before diplomacy had been thoroughly explored. The second quote that I want to read is, "We face profound challenges in the 21st century. Proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, unequal distribution of wealth and the fruits of globalization, I might say, terrorism, environmental degradation, population growth in the developing world, HIV/AIDS, ethnic and religious confrontations. Such problems cannot be resolved by military force, nor by the sole remaining superpower alone. They demand patient, coordinated global effort under the leadership of the United States. the Bush administration has shown that it does not grasp these circumstances of the new era and is not able to rise to the responsibility of world leadership in either style or substance. It is time for a change. Now, that is a pretty sweeping statement.
That's pretty blunt, too.
It is very, very blunt. And I like the fact that they mentioned the fruits of globalization as a major challenge or problem for the 21st century. Now, this was signed by people like Admiral William J. Crow, who is a retired U.S. Navy. He was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Ronald Reagan back in 1985. The Honorable Charles W. Freeman, Jr., he was the ambassador to Saudi Arabia under Bush, Sr. The Honorable William C. Harrop, he was ambassador to Israel under Bush, Sr. General Joseph P. Hoar, he was commander-in-chief of U.S. Central Command under George Bush, Sr. The Honorable Jack F. Matlock, he was ambassador to Soviet Union and the director of European and Soviet Affairs for the National Security Council under Ronald Reagan. Also, there is also another signer is General Merrill A. Tony McPeak of the U.S. Air Force. He's retired. He was the chief of staff of the U.S. Air Force under Bush Sr. He was commander-in-chief of the Pacific Air Forces under Ronald Reagan. So this was a bipartisan group. There were also some officials under Carter and Clinton who signed this as well. So it's a bipartisan group, and these are not just a few guys in the Foreign Office somewhere stuck out, you know, in a Middle East bureau somewhere who are just saying, "Oh, I'm a little discontented. I don't like this, nor is it
a few hippies sitting around singing Give Peace a Chance. I mean, these are people who represent the heart and soul of the American foreign policy establishment, saying that the people that are running the country right now, Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld, are radicals, that they have departed radically from even what the United States has done in the past, as far as its approach to world affairs.
Right.
And not only is it a radical departure and a radical change, but it needs to be overturned. These people are saying basically vote for Kerry in November.
Yeah. And they're not the only ones who are discontented with American foreign policy. A poll actually taken last month by the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq of Iraqi opinion about the U.S. Occupation showed that only 10% of Iraqis wanted U.S. troops in their country. 55% wanted the U.S. to leave immediately. This was back in May, before the interim government was appointed, when the security situation was at its height, when the poor security situation was at its height. Back in May, a majority of Iraqis said, it's time for you to go, and you should go right away. So it's not just some former U.S. diplomats who are saying this and retired military. It is also the Iraqi people themselves saying, get out. It's time to go. And that sums up this week in Iraq.
All right, well, speaking of it's time to go, and all that talk of fruits of globalization is making me hungry. We're almost out of time.
We don't call this Eat the Airwaves for nothing.
Yes, the brunch of globalization.
Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, who are co-editors at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
It is found at bookstores and cafes and places around town where you get free publications. Once again, we are in the midst of a fundraising drive, so you can pay part of the funds that we will raise. Send them now to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145, or on the web. There's also a PayPal for your credit card there at www.eatthestate.org. 8 years of back issues there, too. And you can also find it free, and we'll be down at the Fremont Fair today and tomorrow, tabling down there. So come on down if you're going to be at the fair. Meet us down there. Maria and I will both be down there during the weekend, and some of the other volunteers you can meet as well. So we hope to see you down there.
Where are you going to be at the fair?
In the Community Action Zone, which I guess is somewhere in the middle of the route laid out for.
Yeah, they have a whole area within the tabling and booths where nonprofits and community groups can.
And we'll be in that section.
We'll be there.
The eye of the storm.
Exactly.
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll see you there.
Just follow the sirens. That's right.